The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook if you sign up for a 2-week trial of their service. Audible has 40,000 titles available to download. For all the details, follow the links at guardian.co.uk/audible.
This is Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. On the show this week, I speak to a true iconoclast of cinema. David Lynch will be telling me about a new musical twist to his career. I meet director Rob Lemkin to delve deeper into his award-winning documentary Enemies of the People, bringing us face-to-face with the perpetrators of Cambodia's killing fields. Sam Brooks will be joining me to review Angelina Jolie and Johnny Depp in The Tourist, Mathieu Amalric in On Tour, and Sofia Coppola's Somewhere. Oh, I know where she is. She's here on Film Weekly. Too few directors in cinema manage to carve out both a distinct visual style and at the same time develop over their careers a highly personal musical world through soundtrack and film score. Stanley Kubrick did it, Peter Greenaway, Quentin Tarantino, and without question, the great David Lynch. So his coming out this week as a slick composer of pumping techno and ambient electronica should come as no surprise. So I was delighted to call David at his LA home to hear more about his new musical ventures. But before that, let's hear a sample of David Lynch and his dance floor stylings.
Hello?
Hello, David.
Hey, Jason.
How are you?
Good, thanks.
Excellent. Have you had a good day so far today?
A good day so far, yeah.
that's the best we can hope for, it really. Congratulations on your new single, by the way.
Thanks a lot.
It's great to be I feel like a radio host saying, yeah, that's the new single from David Lynch. Was that some kind of ambition of yours to be played on the radio, like a hit?
Well, you know, not really. It kind of snuck up on me, this music business. It started because of film and my love for sound, and I always wanted a studio where I could experiment, and I got that finally, and the experimenting, you know, was great, and it kind of started going toward music.
Yeah, I mean it's a fine single, may I say. I was at an awards event here that Rob DeBank, who's releasing the music on his Sunday Best label here in the UK. He was DJing at an awards ceremony on Sunday night here at the British Independent Film Awards, and he played your single as a dance floor filler. And the British film industry, they rocked out to David Lynch. I've got to tell you.
Wow, that's beautiful, man.
I thought you'd be pleased.
Great.
Yeah, and it really worked as well. And I know there are. It's interesting, isn't it? Because there are remixes on the way we know of this work. And I think that's kind of odd. You are such a unique artist, David, and your films are so precious to so many people. How different it is to have your music now sort of interpreted by different people. That's a whole different ball game for you, I should imagine.
Yeah. Remixes are, you know, the thing these days, and you know it's great because they have something they just can take off and use it as a point of departure and do their own thing with it, and it's really great to see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, what would someone do that with your films? They couldn't do that. I mean,
probably is going that way.
Yeah, I mean, Inland Empire sort of did that. You did it to yourself, I suppose.
Well, not really. You know, it was a traditional way of getting ideas. Ideas come, but you don't know if they're straight ahead ideas, a straight-ahead story, or if they're more abstract. So it's every time it's different.
Mm-hmm. And we've spoken before. You were a guest on the show 3 or 4 years ago, and we talked about ideas coming like the fish, of course,
right.
as in your book and as you'll meditate. Do the ideas for films, or you mentioned straight or linear or whatever form they come, do they come in the same way that the ideas for music come? I mean, how do they appear
yes,
to you?
Yes, in a way. Everything starts with an idea, and it may be, you know, in film, as I probably told you, I get them in fragments, so they're like little fish, and if you find one that you love, an idea comes that you love, and you see what cinema could do to this idea, it's that you hold that idea, and it becomes like more bait and more swim in, mm-hmm. and a story starts emerging. In music, sometimes it's just a feel, you know, an idea of a feel, of a kind of a beat, and then it's action and reaction, and something comes out.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know how you envisaged your single "Good Day Today" coming out, but I mean, it sounds you can hear the voice of David Lynch there. I think it's been vocoded or whatever the technique was on that. Was that your idea to have that voice? It was always going to be you, or was it a vocal for someone else?
No, it was going to be for me.
Right. So it was always going to. And did you know you'd do it in that kind of, you know, that vocoded way? You sound like,
yeah, for that particular piece, you know. Then there's a B-side, you know, that's more my regular voice.
Yes, a beautiful singing
but,
voice.
You know, these days, you know, we can manipulate things till the cows come home. And so it's such a beautiful world. You can a voice is an instrument. You can change it and make it sound the way you want it to sound.
Yeah. Did you? Are you a singer in general? Are you a singer in the bath, or in the shower?
No.
Kind of thing?
I'm really embarrassed to sing, but I like to try to do it for the music now, and see what it can do.
Yeah. I mean, I know Pedro Almodovar, when he is working on a film, he creates a CD for all the cast members, a mood CD, you know, not the music that's going to be in the film itself, but he sort of gives them tracks and sort of says, well, this is the sort of thing we want in our heads as we're making this. Are you like that? Because your films are so often tied to the sounds that you and Angelo Badalamenti have kind of sculpted for that. Are you aware of the music of your films as you're making them?
Well, yes, if you find it up front. I always say music can conjure ideas. It's really important to be listening to music, because you never know when ideas are going to come out of it. If you find a piece of music up front, during the scene where that music will be, I have it in my headphones, and so does the camera operator, because it makes you, they would make the operator, you know, move the camera in a certain way if that music is in his head.
Yeah, this is,
and I hear the dialogue with that music, and it's a real good indicator if the scene is playing the way you want it to.
Yeah, I mean, do you recall? The score to The Straight Story actually is one of my favorites of yours, and the theme refrains beautifully throughout that movie. But of course, you've got some great music sequences in other works. Wild at Heart has some kind of rocking music as well, and of course, The Lost Highway has David Bowie and Nine Inch Nails. And things like that. Is there a sort of moment that you recall, I must not forget the locomotion dance in Inland Empire as well,
right. An
extraordinary thing. Do you have a sort of, you know, a kind of favorite musical moment in your films?
No, they're all kind of favorites. You know, when it clicks, when it marries to the picture and jumps it, that's the magic. And so you keep trying to find that music that does that. And it's a thrilling thing when it fits.
Yeah, how do you research your music? Obviously, when you work with a composer like Angelo Badalamenti, he'll come up with stuff. But you, a lot of source music in your work as well. Are you a crate digger, or do people kind of present you with stuff and you?
Well,
you
know, you listen to the radio, you know, and you know, people send music. You know, Rammstein sent music to me, and I wasn't listening to it. And then one of the girls that worked here said, you got to listen to, you know, Rammstein. They sent another album, and I listened to it, and it just was the perfect time to listen to it, and it just completely blew my mind, and it was big part of Lost Highway.
Yeah, absolutely. God, I can still hear it reverberating in my ears. I thank you for that. In some way.
The trucks, the transportation department, every truck had Rammstein blasting out the back of it.
the sort of image I have of you, David, is I've never been able to imagine your youth. You've spoken about it many times, growing up in Philadelphia, of course. What was the music, the soundtrack to you growing up? Did you, as you mentioned, listening to the radio, what was the sort of stuff you were listening out for then?
Well, it started, the birth of rock and roll happened in my lifetime. And so I was listening to... Elvis Presley and the Everly Brothers and Roy Orbison and Chuck Berry and Little Richard, mm-hmm. and, there's just so many.
Were you the sort of young man who bought singles and played them on gramophones?
Yeah, I bought a lot of singles, 45s.
Yeah, and you would play them in the house.
Fleetwoods were mm-hmm. giant then. There was so much great music, and the British invasion, as you know.
Mm-hmm. You remember the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show screaming away?
Yes, I do.
I saw
the Beatles in Washington D.C. when they first came, and I thought they played New York first, but now I'm not so sure. They might have played D.C. and then went back up to New York and played. So I saw them in 64.
Yeah, they were at Shea Stadium, though. I always thought was the key gig. But anyway, I'm not a Beatles expert, I have to say. But I'm amazed that you've seen them as well, which is brilliant. This is the day that John Lennon died, by the way, as well. So we mark that with a little Lynchian Beatles moment. It all connects, David, I think, in some way.
Right.
The music, we have some of our... I know you're going to do a Twitter chat for some Guardian fans in a minute. One of the questions that someone wanted to ask you on our side was John Coltrane. They don't know if you know John Coltrane's music or
yes.
in one way, but they sort of feel that he has influenced you in some way, and wanted to know if that was true.
Well, not really, but jazz has, and like you asked what I was listening to, but Blue Ronda a la Turk, Dave Brubeck's album came out, I think, in 1959.
Yeah.
And that record, just drove me crazy. I loved it so much.
Yes, and I mean he's 90 this week, I think, Dave Brubeck again.
Really, so, and truly,
yeah.
Wow.
You're chiming with all these anniversaries. Yeah, he's 90
yeah.
years old, and people still say he kind of, taught the audience to clap in the wrong time. I think it was
exactly right.
But yeah, you've always seemed, slightly. It's that kind of. It sounds out of time, and like your movies, they look, but they don't quite normal. They're not quite. There's something off kilter in that oh so brilliant way, and I can definitely see the influence of Brubeck and that modernist kind of good vibe in your films. Now, David, it's wonderful to have you around doing a single and stuff on the dance floors, but obviously this is a film show. When are you coming back to the cinemas?
Well, I'm right now, Jason, I'm trying to catch ideas for the next film,
and that could be. So this says Little Fish. We just don't even know where they're going to pop up.
No, we don't, and. Some have popped up, but not enough to get out the cameras.
All right, but you're coming back. You haven't abandoned it altogether.
No, not at all.
No, you're not going to be doing off rock tours and stuff, and being
no.
on the road. We'll never see him again. the some people have asked also why now you're doing a single. Often a band would do a video to go with it, and would there be a David Lynch video? Will you be doing the video yourself? And what sort of work?
No, there's a video contest on. Going right now, and people can join the contest and make a video, and I think the winners will be announced January 3rd.
Really? So I can make my own David Lynch video to go with your single? if I wanted to. I'm not going to do that, but we can encourage
them. Jason.
We shall encourage people to do that. I wish I should have taken all the British film industry dancing to your song. That would have been a brilliant kind of like the Locomotion in Inland Empire. In fact, there's also another project called the Lynch Three project.
That's my friend Jason.
Yeah.
Who did Lynch 1 and 2, and now he's trying to raise money to do the third.
Yes, I know you've designed some wonderful T-shirts and bags to sort of go with that.
To help him raise the money. He followed me around for almost a year, and so he's got a lot of footage still.
Right, and it's interviews with you, or a day in the life of?
No, it's just, whatever I'm doing, he's there, and I it's a strange thing, but I got very used to him, he just disappeared, So it's I don't know what he'll do, if he'll add new stuff or what, but that's what Lynch 3 is.
Right. So how do you feel? I mean, you're an artist who has, you obviously do very personal work, but also you're behind the camera a lot of the time. Being up front, being a performer, as in the music, and then being the subject of this documentary type
it's
work.
It's very strange. That's why I say, even though he's there, some people, I think, it would interfere with the process, but for some reason I feel okay with him there. I don't know why.
Right. And do you do any particular sort of exercises as an actor? Is it you're different as a performer when the camera's
no,
there?
No, I'm not performing. It's he's just following me whatever I'm working on.
But you don't feel that when the camera's on, we're a different person.
No, that's a tricky thing, Jason. I think when you know the camera's there, you are slightly different, and so it's a tricky thing to be, to have that person and that camera disappear, and so I'm just saying that for some reason it disappears, almost completely when he's around.
Right, yeah, it's the trust, I suppose, and you have that with some of the actresses that you've worked with, I suppose, like Laura and Naomi Watts. I suppose it needs a certain artistic chiming together to create that kind of space, that special space.
Exactly right.
Yeah. Well, have you meditated yet today, David? Just like to
for
know.
For sure.
Good. Good. You've had a good morning. That's all right. So you're single, which is sort of a mantra. Good day today. Is did that come out of that sort of thing? Because it feels to me it's a very good motto to start any day with.
Yes. Well, it would be beautiful if people did have a good day every day.
Yeah. Exactly.
And that's the point. Life is supposed to be blissful.
I think people would say, that's great to hear David Lynch say that, but a lot of people would kind of think, it's not really the portrait that you paint for your pictures all the time.
Get ideas, and I always say the world conjures, so many ideas, and the world is, I think everybody's fascinated with, stories. And, a story of all good news is be very boring.
But this is true.
It would be nice to have all good news in the so-called real life and have all the torment and all the, intrigue and the highs and lows in the films.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I can't wait for the next Lynch film, as I suppose a lot of people can't. I wish you much luck catching those little fishes and making a whole shoal of ideas into your next movie.
Thanks, Jason.
Until then, we will content ourselves by tapping our feet to your, which I must say, excellent dance single, David Lynch.
Jason.
Next time you're here, I'll see you down the disco and we'll have a little boogie and then come on Film Weekly and tell us about your new film, because that'll be our next opportunity. So until then, many thanks, David Lynch. Congratulations on a rocking...
Thank you very much, Jason. You have a good day today.
I will. Thanks, David.
Okay, pal.
Bye.
Bye.
From Eraserheads to Filmhead, Sam Brooks, Guardian's roving film critic, joins me to discuss the week's releases. Sam, we're going to look at Somewhere, we're going to look at The Tourist, we're going to look at On Tour, we can talk about Voyage of the Dawn Treader. Lots to get through, Sam. So let's go into the Venice Film Festival Golden Lion winner this year, Sofia Coppola's Somewhere. Let's have a little clip before you tell us about it. Father and daughter, Stephen Dorff and Elle Fanning, talking in a car.
You're really good.
Thanks.
When did you learn how to ice skate?
I've been going for 3 years.
Really? Is that the same SUV?
There's kind of a lot of those in LA.
Yeah, but I think that's the same one.
A very moody little slice of Somewhere. It's all about mood, Somewhere, isn't it?
Well, I guess it is. It's basically a coffee table book masquerading as a movie, I think, this. It's very well shot by Harris Savidas.
Yeah, great cinematographer.
And it's a film of surfaces, I suppose. It's a film about the indolent rich. So Stephen Dorff plays this Hollywood movie star called Johnny Marco, who lives at the Chateau Marmont in Los Angeles. And then is landed.
Would you like to live at the Chateau Marmont?
I have, many times. Yeah.
You and John Belushi.
Yeah, but that was, you know, a long time ago, and I've cleaned up my act.
It was quite nice.
And that is really what Johnny Marco should be doing, because he's got a lovely little daughter called Cleo, played by Elle Fanning. And she perhaps offers him a shot at redemption.
And is this, and I still haven't seen Somewhere. I haven't seen it. It won the Golden Lion. Tarantino was sort of accused of favouritism awarding it. Neither of us saw it at Venice. But, I mean, now that you've kind of pieced that together, a just award, or do you think there was something
odd going on? No, not at all. It's a film that almost to not see it is to see it, in a way. That there's nothing really here. I mean, where is Somewhere?
Yeah.
There's no centre to it.
Does it know that? Is that why it's called
Somewhere? Well, I guess so. But that only takes you up to a point. I mean, I'm sure that this is... I have no problem with a rich young person making a film about rich young people.
Yeah, it's kind of good to stick with what you know.
Yeah,
really.
Exactly. It'd be more suspect if she made a film about junkies on Skid Row, wouldn't it? But you have to care about these people. Mm. Otherwise, what on earth is the point? And I think that all the details here probably do ring true, and this is probably a very true portrait of the world of the indolent super rich. But so what? Why should we care about these people?
I mean, in a way, Fellini did it in La Dolce Vita. We looked at that kind of indolence and that kind of surface. But there was feeling and pain behind that.
Yeah,
surface.
Here there's really nothing.
Okay.
Maybe it's that Dorff doesn't quite communicate enough, doesn't carry enough weight. Fanning is very good as the daughter, but she's this sort of idealised little pure slice of saintly innocence. So there's not a whole lot she can do with that.
It's totally autobiographical.
She's got a kind of daddy fixation, hasn't she?
Yeah.
So it's all about father daughters, whether that be in Lost in Translation or here. You know, there's also a slight problem with it in that I think she's guilty of a slight sneering elitism in a lot of her films, that all of her films I find to be about these sort of sad, lonely Olympians being administered to by
poor Marie Antoinette, who cakes.
You by, know. You know, being sort of serviced by slightly idiotic, silly little people.
Yeah.
So here you've got the kind of, like Lost in Translation, you've got the kind of the idiot journalists who are asking stupid questions in the press conference.
Yes, we're so thick, aren't we?
We're so dumb. And it's her upstairs, downstairs kind of sensibility that she has.
What do you think it is that attracted Tarantino to awarding it a Golden Lion? Where's the artistry that he saw in it?
I think the artistry, you know, without wanting to get into legal issues, is probably more in the bedroom than on the screen. You know,
I can't even imagine him being an artist in the bedroom at all. But
she is on one level a talented filmmaker. If you judge an auteur by somebody who makes their own, you know, puts their own imprint on a film, she's totally that. No one else could make a film like this. She has her own sensibility, and it comes through very, very clearly. But I don't care.
That's Sofia Coppola's Venice winner, Somewhere. From a Venice winner to a film set in Venice, it's Angelina Jolie and Johnny Depp starring together in The Tourist. They meet on a train, Chris Cross.
I'm Elise.
I'm Frank.
That's a terrible name.
It's the only one I've got.
Maybe we can find you another.
Okay. What brings you to Venice?
You read spy novels. I'm a mysterious woman on a train. You tell me what my story is.
Okay. I think you'd be a diplomatic attaché. Or maybe a girl from East Germany whose father's been kidnapped. And they're blackmailing you into stealing something for them. Probably a microfilm. It's usually microfilm involved.
What awaits me?
Trouble, certainly.
Danger.
Oh, yeah. You'll most likely be shot at in less than two chapters.
Is there a man in my life?
I have to wait and see.
Reference to Strangers on a Train. I like train movies, and I like train movies that kind of beetle through Europe on a kind of Orient Express kind of stuff.
Did this one test your love for
those? Oh my God, this was the most boring train journey I've ever seen. The train was boring. I mean, for the first minute, I was like, this is boring.
Yeah.
What's going on? Angelina Jolie comes on, sits next to Johnny Depp, and they talk in a stilted manner, and I'm thinking, things are not what they seem. I'm not sure I give a damn what they are, but they're not what they seem. Were you hooked?
No, I wasn't. I mean, to kind of basically put people in the picture with regards to the plot, Angelina Jolie is the sort of a beautiful gangster's mole who is being pursued by Interpol, and but
she's
also
British, of course.
She's British, being pursued also by a Russian oligarch, and Johnny Depp plays the sort of hapless, galumphing American maths teacher who gets kind of caught up in the intrigue.
You know where they say, oh, he's a maths teacher from Wisconsin? You think they've just made that up. I mean, that he's not, you know, he's invented a sort of John Doe for himself. From the first second, I was thinking, this is not working.
Well, the whole film felt made up. It felt like the sort of film that you would get if you got a kind of bunch of morons together and said, here's $100 million, you've got to make an espionage caper movie, but you've only got a weekend to do it from scratch. That there seemed to be no plot here, even though three different scriptwriters, including Julianne Fellowes, are credited here.
And Chris McQuarrie, who did The Usual Suspects as well, so you're thinking, ooh, twists and things that obviously...
And director Florian von Donnersmarck.
Forget the Donkel.
And he's a baron. Yeah.
He is Baron Florian Donkel von Donnersmarck, who made The Lives of Others.
Lives of Others, which I didn't really like either.
Well, I thought it was very over-promoted.
Absolutely.
For what it was. I mean, I like films where people wear headphones and kind of listen into stuff. And there was a lot of that going on. And I'm thinking, well, he's a funny auteur because there's a lot of that in this one because Paul Bettany plays the police kind of guy who's tracking them on Interpol. And I was like, that's a strange kind of shtick to have as a director. I do films where people wear earphones a lot.
that's his signature, isn't it? This really just didn't work at all. I mean, we were talking earlier about sort of turkeys of the year, and I think this is it.
It's
kind of
close.
Like waddled in late.
Yeah, there's another, I mean, Night and Day that Tom Cruise did with Cameron Diaz, which was another sort of comic caper disaster. I thought it was an absolute mess. And, you know, if you don't get the tone right in these kind of light comic capers,
it dies.
They just boom. And these two could be found at the bottom of a canal quite soon, I think. From The Tourist to On Tour, Matthew Almeric, former Bond villain. He directs and stars in a movie about a burlesque troupe who aren't going to Paris.
Nantes, La Rochelle, Toulon.
Which one about Paris?
You gotta ask the boss. He didn't mention it.
It's strange, no?
I'm sure he has a plan, an idea. A petite surprise.
Non.
Quoi? Mais je t'emmerde! Putain!
Matthew Almeric there, who was, of course, the Bond villain Dominic Green in Quantum of Solace.
Yeah.
Here he is. He's got loads of strippers with him.
He's got loads of strippers. You know, that's a promotion, I guess, isn't it?
I think so. It looks more fun than hanging out with miserable old Daniel Craig.
Although I sort of fear for his safety with these strippers, because Matthew Almeric is a sort of small, little kind of ferrety man, and these strippers tower above him. And there's a lot of arguments in this film, and each time there's an argument, you kind of fear for his safety a little bit.
These strippers are called things like Dirty Martini and Rocky Roulette.
Yes.
Are they as exotic a performers as their name suggests, do you think?
Well, one of them pulls a row of streamers out of her bum while the band plays God Bless America or something. So, you know, that's nice work.
That's something.
You can get it.
Yeah. I like the one who's got that funny... There's a really good act with an arm. She's got like a hand that sort of speaks. It's very kind of...
Yeah, like the Mel Gibson in The Beaver.
Yes. This was, I mean, we talked about it in Cannes. It was sort of the first film we saw in Cannes. It was in competition there. He surprisingly won Best Director at Cannes. I think everyone was a bit shocked when that happened. But there is something to this film. It's got a sort of, it, by turns, sort of riotous, glorious mournfulness.
It has. It's one of those films that that what you tend to criticise about it is what it's trying to do. It's a film about rootlessness and transience and not leaving much trace and sort of shuttling from one place to the next. And when I was watching it, I was thinking, now there's got to be more here. And there's not. It's totally ephemeral and it just sort of fades away.
And as such, and I mean, yet, that final sequence there in this hotel, in this drab scene, and I was thinking, well, there's no plot, you know, there's no show, if you like.
But they've found a sort of refuge, haven't they?
And I can see it and smell it and feel it.
Absolutely. And it has a great pungent sense of the sort of France that we rarely get to see on screen, the France of sort of slightly depressed small towns, and sort of chain motels where they're always playing Muzak in the lobby and filling stations. And it's very evocative in that way. And actually, I really kind of like this, and I like it the more I think about it.
It grows on. It's a grower. It's kind of the sort of Sofia Coppola might have been trying to do.
Well, yeah, and it's making a bonus of its sort of rootlessness, I think. And I think Amalric is a good, solid actor at the centre of it. You know, maybe it's a bit of a cliched role. It's the guy whose life's falling apart. He's chain smoking like a madman.
Doesn't he get an award? He should get an award for smoking.
He really should. And he's got the sort of the sons from the broken marriage that he's trying to kind of look after too. And he's juggling all these things, and it's all going to sort of hell in a handcart. But he does it very well. And maybe he didn't deserve the best actor, best director at Cannes. But it's certainly a worthwhile film.
Yeah, and he's a bit of a French national treasure as well.
He is.
So, well done. We always like seeing Mathieu Amalric. Zan, let's do some kids stuff. The third in the Chronicles of Narnia, Voyage of the Dawn Treader, based on C.S. Lewis's books. Children disappear into a painting and end up in Narnia.
Lucy, have you seen this ship before?
Yes. It's very Narnian looking, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, just another reminder that we're here and not there.
There once were two orphans who wasted their time believing in Narnian nursery rhyme. What's so fascinating about that picture, anyway? It's hideous.
Edmund, it looks like the water's actually moving.
What rubbish, see? That's what happens when you read all those fanciful novels and fairy tales.
Edmund, the painting!
Oh, the smashable thing!
Don't use the thing! No!
This was in 3D. Did you see it in 3D?
I did, yeah.
That bit of the goggles worked really well. I thought
was
the water came
the
out of the painting.
The film,
that's great.
The rest of the film sort of struggles to live up to that,
doesn't it?
The kind of wallop of that moment. And as perhaps this struggles to live up, you know, there's this slight sense of diminishing returns with these Narnia films. So, you know, I was a big fan of the books as a kid.
Yeah, me too. I sort of did read them.
And I liked the first film. The second one wasn't so good, and it did badly at the box office. So then the whole franchise was kind of on a knife edge for a little bit, and now they're kind of continuing with it. I don't think this really... I don't know why it doesn't quite work. I think possibly the Lewis books are too much of an obvious sort of moralistic allegory, that when you put that on screen, it feels a bit clunky.
A little bit. Here comes Liam Neeson as a lion.
And he's actually God.
And you're God or Jesus or any Messiah, permanent God from whichever you
are. Oh, no, I think C.S. Lewis would very much stipulate
really?
That
you don't
it's
think
the
he's
one
a Jewish
God.
Lion?
I don't think he's a Muslim God or, you know,
one
of any
of those.
One of
the four lions from Chris Morris's film. It's a sort of children's book. I think the problem with it is that there's a quest going on there. I don't know quite know what they were after when they got to Narnia.
It's very episodic, isn't it? I mean, and that's the nature of the story, that they're on this boat kind of island hopping, and so they meet dragons and wizards and strange sort of doings and things like that. And yet it becomes a bit laborious. You
good
think, onto the next... Yeah, good dragon.
The dragon was the kid from Son of Rambo. I like Eustace.
He's very good, isn't he? Yeah. And if the franchise continues... then there's further life for Eustace. And actually, I think that the next book, The Silver Chair, is probably the best one.
Yeah, and I think they are making that.
I hope so.
I got Michael Apted in the director's chair. It was kind of an odd choice, him doing it. But I think he had quite fun. He got to sit next to the Queen and wear 3D goggles.
Yeah, and we all want to do that,
don't we? That's something we must do. Zan, very nice to see you. Thank you very much for coming in, as ever. To read all of Zan's reviews and see his beautiful videos, go to guardian.co.uk/film. Hello.
ពលពតក្រុមកាន់កាប់ការប្រជុំ ông xong sẽ khơi tập phôi phôi mới.
Bà khơi phôi phôi.
I just know that Sim Pol Pot died. Only this man, Nujia, can tell us why the killing happened. My project is to find out why so many people die in the killing fields. I do this work not just for my father, my mother, and my brother. I do this for all the people.
That's the voice of Cambodian investigative journalist and co-director of Enemies of the People, Tet Sambat. The documentary is a courageous and dogged investigation into the people who committed the industrial-scale killings of fellow Cambodians under the Pol Pot regime of the 1970s, from the throat-slitting foot soldiers all the way to Pol Pot's brother number two, Nuom Chea, the last surviving senior leader who breaks a 30-year silence on the killings to reveal the mindset of those in charge. A triumph both at Sundance and at the British Independent Film Awards last Sunday here in the UK, the film is co-directed with Tet Sambat by one of the UK's most established documentarists, Rob Lemkin. It's an honour to have him in the studio with me today. Welcome to Film Weekly, Rob.
Thanks.
Congratulations, Jason. Sunday night winner of BIFFA's documentary category. That's the start of stuff, because you're on the Oscar long list as well.
We are. Yeah. We are, yeah. No, there's a long way to go.
So it's thrilling for a filmmaker, but thrilling also for, I suppose, the subject as well, because it means that more people are talking about this kind of, I suppose, what is a sort of well-known episode, notoriously well-known episode, but no one's really done much about it ever on film, apart from David Putnam's film, The Killing Fields.
That's right, yeah, exactly. And it's quite often compared to that film as being a way of, oh, this is a sort of a landmark, iconic film. Putnam and I are talking on Friday at the ICA about that. But I think that's also been the case in America when the film's been shown there. Cambodian Americans have been coming out to see the film in their droves, and they actually, a lot of them come out of the cinema saying, wow, that was amazing. I haven't been to the cinema since I came to see The Killing Fields, but it's great to see our story up there on the big screen.
Yeah, I mean, the point that, but the film that I love about the film is that it's not just about Cambodia. Obviously, you're following Sambat, Tet, and his explorations, but it really is about what documentaries can do. They can record history and how important it is to have that recorded, isn't it?
It is, yeah, it's totally. And it's also about the kind of the human condition of what happens if sort of someone comes up to you one day and says, I want you to kill some people for us. Is it okay? Here's a knife. Go and do it. And you start doing it, and then you do it more, and then you do it more, and then you do it more. Of course, luckily, that isn't a human condition that most of us have to experience.
Unfortunately, quite a few have, though, probably more than care to admit it. And it's about admitting that. I mean, obviously, you know, you could do this there are a few surviving Nazis, but that sort of thing. We're sort of people in armies who've been conscripted. We've all sort of kind of been touched by it in some way. The more I think about it, the more I watch your film, there's room in there to think, how does this relate to me? How did you get involved in it? Because obviously you're joining the investigative journalist from Cambodia, Tet Sambat, on his exploration. He's been doing it for 10 years. How did you come along into it, Rob?
Yeah, he'd been doing it for 7 years when I met him. And I went there because I wanted to make a film about the trial of the Khmer Rouge, which was being talked about then, and judges were being sworn in, and it looked like they were actually going to reel these old guys in after 30 years and, put them in the dock. And I thought, well, this would be really interesting to see these guys doing it. And Sambat was my fixer and translator very early on. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I couldn't really get any joy out of these. I went to see a couple of these people, the old Khmer Rouge people. I couldn't get anything out of them. But I realized that his relationship with particularly brother number two, who became the main character in our film, was incredibly interesting and incredibly deep and incredibly long-lasting. And on the way back from going to his house and having failed miserably to film anything of any interest, we spent the day going all the way back to Phnom Penh, and he told me about the work that he'd been doing for, at that point, 7 years. To get this guy to tell him all the stuff that actually he hadn't just told me. And I just thought, this is incredible. How can we do a film? He had actually just at that point begun filming. Before that, he'd been just going and visiting and talking.
An amazing patience that he's required to. But I mean, without his 7 years of hard work, sort of ingratiating himself, befriending the family, they would never have opened up, you think?
Absolutely not, no.
Why do you think that Cambodia needs to sort of to get this episode sort of sorted?
Well, I think Cambodia needs to get this episode sorted is because they don't really understand why it happened. And all of the people who did it, because you don't get 1.7 million people dead just by two or three old guys in a room saying, oh, should we kill them? Or loads of people have to be involved. Mm. No one has really come out into the open and said, this is what we did. And so you have this whole society which is living in a kind of, you know, there's a sort of mysterious veil over a whole kind of proportion of the population. And people don't talk about it. And it is, I think, a huge kind of impedance to the general kind of development of the society. Yeah,
I mean,
and
I've been to Cambodia, I've been to Phnom, and I've been to Angkor Wat, obviously, what I go to, what they call Angelina Jolie Temple now, most dishearteningly, I must say. And that is an incredible place. But I was thinking about it in relation to this, because it's a place where nature has overtaken man's construct. No one quite knows what happened, Angkor Wat, and the trees now kind of invade it, and it's beautiful. Your documentary shows paddy fields, rice fields, palm trees growing, but we know the bodies are underneath there. There's a disappeared civilization, 1.7 million people, you say, under there. There's a lot. Those shots are extremely eloquent, Rob.
It is. It's a kind of a subterranean sort of dead population, really, that's there, that's submerged in the water. And that is, I think that's a really important thing, because that gets you into the consciousness of the people who live there. I mean, they are living surrounded by the places that all this happened. And even the people that did it, I mean, there's a scene in our film where one guy, a guy called Singh, starts off saying, oh, I didn't kill anyone. Mm. I didn't kill anyone. Must have been someone. You're thinking of someone else. And gradually sort of says, okay, yeah, I did kill one. And actually, later, one of his colleagues says, no, not one. He killed many. And, yeah. And in reality, he is now admitting to killing many. But he started off with one. And the one person that he admitted to killing was somebody who he actually buried under the tree at the end of his garden.
There's an amazing bit of in your film, Rob, where one of the farmers, the sort of peasants, is sort of shows us how they did it, how they're killing, and he borrows a boy and sort of says, "Do you mind if I practice on you?" And he goes, "No, well, I'm going to take." He takes a knife, lifts his head up, and sort of at mime slitting his throat, but with a blade. I mean, that's you were there for filming that.
Well, of course, yeah, I was there for filming. I filmed pretty much 90%.
But you kind of know that was going to happen.
No, we had planned that film. In fact, that scene was very, very carefully planned. It was Sambat who wanted to do that right scene. And what he wanted to do was something even more extraordinary and almost sort of impossible to believe. He wanted to give a real knife to Sun, who was this killer, who he knows really well and had known for several years. He wanted to give him a real knife and ask Sun to do a demonstration of how he slit throats back in the 1970s on himself. And I said, Sambat, I don't think we're not making this for BBC, but we certainly wouldn't get it through health and safety if we were, type yeah thing. So should we go and get a plastic knife or something, just a little bit? I'd be much happier if we could do that, because it's just me and him. I have no crew. If something were to go wrong, I do not have kind of sort of assistants yeah around the place who can sort of say, jump in and do it. It was just me filming. So we got a plastic knife. And actually, he originally, as I say, Sambat really wanted this perpetrator, this killer, to actually show how he killed him. And he wanted Sambat wanted to be the victim, yeah, which is a really weird thing, because his father was killed in that way.
Well,
by
there's
many
always,
people
I mean, there's
stabbing
much
him
is made in the film, the fact that he doesn't want to sort of admit that he's doing this out of some kind of revenge, because his father and brother, his family were killed in that regime. That is clearly, though, where there is some motivation in him, as well as a kind of personal vendetta. But it's amazing how it's sort of, I don't know, mitigated into investigation.
I think that's a very interesting way of putting it, mitigated into investigation. And certainly the way that we created we constructed the film, where we cut the film here in England, we cut it as one huge act of revenge.
I thought it was absolutely, you know, I couldn't take my eyes off it. Extraordinary piece of work. Congratulations. Best of luck when the Oscar nominations come out. And, you know, all good for Cambodia, I suppose. Rob Lemkin, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you very much, Jason.
And as Rob mentioned in his interview there, he is talking on Friday at the ICA with David Putnam, comparing The Killing Fields to his documentary, Enemies of the People. For information about that, go to ica.org.uk. Thanks to all my guests this week. Remember, we're keen to hear your views on any of the films we cover. Do join us on Facebook, Film Weekly Fans, that's us. In particular, at the moment, we want your top three films of the year. Myself and Zan Brooks are constructing our own top 10 lists as we speak, but we really want to know what you thought was the cinematic cream of the crop of 2010. The music featured on the podcast this week is the pumping cinematic techno of David Lynch. Worth checking out, buying it even on iTunes. Don't forget you can catch my latest In the Director's Chair with director Michael Apted, who's just done the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, the Narnia Tales, but we talk about his whole career from Coronation Street through the 7-Up series, through Gorillas in the Mist to the Dawn Treader. But for now, on Film Weekly, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer, Jason Phipps, it's see you next week. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.